Well, good evening, everyone. Tonight we are going to be working into, hopefully, a successful live stream. If you were able to log in last week and watch the debacle of low bandwidth knock us out of the teaching of St. Patrick's Confessions, then I'm hoping that we are not going to have a redo of last week. So, but tonight, as we work into St. Patrick's Confessions, we are going to be hopefully looking at establishing our understanding of this fifth century saint. These lessons are always such a privilege to prepare and to work through things. I can definitely say anyone who really goes through church history without working through primary sources, it really doesn't get to see some of the greatest stuff that we get to learn. And so one of the things I love about this kind of initiative that we're doing here is that we have the freedom and the time to look into all of the aspects of church history from the very earliest beginnings, and not just to see overviews and stories and secondary stories and tertiary information, but to really delve down into the writings of Christians themselves. As we always say here, the goal here is to learn wisdom. This is one of the main aspects of the Christian life, and church history is no different. It is like all forms of fellowship. We have other Christians in our lives to help us walk the way of wisdom, the way of righteousness, as we continue to head towards our Lord. And so when we study church history, it is absolutely pertinent to us to study primary sources. And tonight is no exception. Now, I planned this for last week, obviously, because this past Sunday was St. Patrick's Day. And I wanted to kind of, you know, defeat some of the theories about him, some of the myths and some of the legends, because honestly, there's very few people throughout church history that have so many myths and legends about them told. And so when we really settle down and talk about St. Patrick, it really stands to us to actually hear him in his own words, because for 1500 years, he has had an entire culture of Christianity be birthed out of his reputation. And so that reputation has definitely grown in some areas, shrinked in other areas, but in all ways, one of the great things that we have is his own writings preserved. And so that is what we're going to spend our night with this evening, and that is St. Patrick's Confessions, a 15th century missionary's story told in his own words. When we talk about St. Patrick, there's a few things that just help us get aligned. We are not discussing somebody who chased snakes out of Ireland. That never happened. These types of stories are embellishments that come after the fact. And really, you know, they may have a kernel of truth, such as the chasing out of the Druids or false teachers and so forth, and metaphorically referred to as snakes or whatnot. But the idea of physically chasing snakes off of the island, which I fear many have heard before and just assumed was a literal retelling of history. There is no historical evidence for this. There's no primary, secondary sources or anything contemporary that talks about such things. But as far as for him chasing out false teachers and druids and all sorts of things, oh boy, yes. We have him par excellence. And so I actually find that is a more fascinating story than someone who's chasing snakes out of Ireland. And so when we come to Patrick's life, when we come to his ministry, we come to a very unusual story and one that has affected so many people. And like all people who do good things, there is an assumption by some that they did it wrongly. And it's kind of like, if you're not familiar, there's this old story of the man in the arena, the one that's doing the fighting, the one that's doing the hard work. It's really, really easy to criticize the one who's doing the hard work. And it's really, really hard to be the one in the arena doing the hard work that needs to be done. Well, Patrick, towards the end of his life, was reaping the rewards of a lot of faithful years of service in Ireland. And there was a lot of people going around spreading rumors, gossip, and things like this that destroy people. And they were trying to undermine him, trying to destroy his reputation, trying to undo some of the things that he was doing, trying to steal some of the reflected glory, by the way. That was going on as well. And so in response to that, Patrick actually writes a semi-autobiography, but really more of a defense of himself and his ministry. And therein we have about 90-95% of all of the information about Patrick, and it's by his own hand. And so as anyone can tell you, when you have firsthand account that is contemporary, that is remarkable history to have. It doesn't mean it's all exactly true, right? I mean, if I wrote my own autobiography, just because I put something in there doesn't mean it's 100% true, but it does reflect my perspective, and it certainly does reflect true history. And so there are aspects to this story and to the confessions that we'll read that you may look at that and go, oh, that's a little strange, it's a little weird. And then there's other parts of it that you go, okay, that makes perfect sense. That makes sense here and there, and this one comports to reality, and that kind of interaction with it is really healthy, and that's part of what we do in history studies, especially when dealing with primary sources, and especially when they are autobiographical in nature. And so there's a couple of words about Patrick himself. He is writing this, again, towards the end of his life. There's a lot of themes of his faith, his dependence on the grace of God throughout it. The divine call is very, very prominent throughout. You will see him interacting in dreams. You will see him interacting in impressions and so forth. Now, his particular flavor of Christianity, if you will, would have been Roman Christianity in the Britain Empire, in Britannia, actually, which is in the Roman Empire at this point. And then he sees Ireland as the ends of the earth. After that is the unconquered ocean. And so he sees kind of this as one of the final frontiers, if you will, of missionary pushes. And, you know, even from his own perspective, you're talking 400 years after Christ. It's been a while. Right? The silence between the testaments was about the same amount of time. And so there was even people kind of assessing around this time that kind of silence that has been, where we haven't had more scripture given, Christ has not returned yet. There is kind of this feeling that perhaps now that, the Roman Empire is now a Christian empire, perhaps now that we have the ends of the world having the gospel preached to them, there was a lot of people that were expecting the end of the world. In fact, that is a theme, as you well know, that has come up throughout history over and over and over again, and is certainly we are not given to much else but the same in our own present age. If any of you know me personally, know I do not typically interact with history as though we are living at the end of it. I typically interact with history as though we have a responsibility to hand down things, because this may well go on for another 50 generations. It's kind of always been the case, hasn't it? When we run into Patrick, though, he interacts with these things. It is so real to him. It is so personal to him. And this does reflect a great deal of influence from the culture around him at the time, the British Isles. I'm going to call them that, even though that's anachronistic. Ireland itself and all of these things had a much closer understanding of Spiritism and the physicality of the world. That this world and the mystical world of the spiritual realm overlap in ways that other cultures really don't. If you live in the Western world today, even if you live in Ireland today, you do not live in a culture, neither do I, that appreciates how close the spiritual realm is to the physical realm. But Patrick does. And so for him, it would not be something strange to assume that his dreams have meaning, that his dreams are even of direct revelation. And you'll see him interact with some of these things as he goes on. Some of the background of this, though, continually addressing the points that his response and his main emphasis throughout these confessions will be on his faith in God, even for daily food, like for everything for provisions, not even just in the spiritual, but again, he lives in a crossover culture, so the spiritual and the physical are together. If God, scratch that, since God is supplying salvation, he also will be faithful to provide me food and income and safety from a storm. There's an understanding that these things are linked. Excuse me. He also addresses some of the concepts of providence, and you'll see this here in the text. I just kind of want to give you an alignment before we get into the text. You'll see him discuss concepts of suffering as a way that God brings the unrighteous to him. He sees this in his own life. He was captured and into slavery when he was 16, and then he was able to escape and through other means, and then returned to the place of his captivity, which was Ireland, in his early 20s to, again, or into his 20s, in order to be a missionary there and bring the gospel to them. He sees suffering actually has not just a purpose for the unrighteous, but also for the righteous, that they may be a faithful witness to the hope that they have in God. And so if Christians suffer, when they suffer, their main testimony really comes out in their sufferings. It doesn't come out in times of ease. And this is a spark of wisdom that I honestly feel the vast majority of the modern day church, at least in the West, has almost completely forgotten. For our Eastern Orthodox brothers and sisters, I will readily admit, y'all have a much better concept of the purpose of suffering than we do. This is something we have to really consider and learn through a lot of hardships and a lot of difficulties. We don't naturally think about suffering as a divine good for the righteous. We don't naturally think that way. And so it takes us time, it takes us focus, it takes intentionality. And this is something that Patrick will help us with this evening. And that's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to look into this. That and the fact that it's, you know, St. Patrick's Day week. What wisdom he said that he had in his late life was not his, but it was gifted to him. This is something that I have spoken on the nature of wisdom and how it comes to us. It is something that God gives to us. It is not something that we naturally dig down and find. Wisdom is then therefore seen as synonymous with God's leadership, his righteousness to us, and then we see wisdom born out of that. It is part and parcel to our Christian witness. It is part of who we are, and it is part of God's provision, just as much as food and salvation. Wisdom is gifted to us. You know what? I could talk more about this, but let's get right into the text, because I'm honestly kind of looking forward to this, and that's always my favorite thing to do. And there's nothing much better than to actually see it in his own writing. So let's delve into this. It is not a terribly long book, and we're not going to read every aspect of it. You can just see as I kind of go through. We're going to be paying attention to the bold sections. There's what, 62 paragraphs, I think it is? Don't worry, we're not reading all of those. But these bold sections are absolutely helpful and necessary to look into, to glean this wisdom from somebody who is very, very helpful to our understandings here. Oh, let's see. Somebody comments here. Andres Acosta. This is my first time making it to the live show. I've been listening all day today. What a coincidence. Oh, marvelous. Well, welcome. Glad you can make the live show. Not many people make it to the live show. That's just fine. It won't always be a live show, but I'm glad you're here tonight for this. Let's look into this together, yeah? So here we go. Autobiography. Defense of himself. My name is Patrick. I am a sinner, a simple country person, and the least of all believers. I am looked down upon by many. Now, I will quickly make note, this is towards the end of his life. He has at this point baptized countless thousands of people, has formed many monasteries, has ordained almost countless clerics, and has almost single-handedly routed out all animism on the island of Ireland towards here, the end of his life, and to find himself in the situation of being looked down upon by many should really give us pause about how we think about our relationship to our press. Anyway, keep going. My father was Calpurnius. He was a deacon. His father was Potitus, a priest who lived at Benavim Tabernae. His home was near there, and that is where I was taken prisoner. I was about 16 at the time. At that time, I did not know the true God. I was taken into captivity in Ireland, along with thousands of others. We deserved this. This is an important concept of God's providence. We deserved this because we had gone away from God and did not keep his commandments. We would not listen to our priests. Those would be Roman Catholic priests in the 5th century in Britannia. We would not listen to our priests who advised us about how we could be saved. The Lord brought us his strong anger upon us and scattered us among many nations, even to the ends of the earth. There he refers to Ireland. It was among foreigners that it was seen how little I was. This concept of him deserving this slavery at 16 years old, he connects directly with the concept of him not listening to the priests. Not listening to them about salvation, not listening to them about the importance of who God is. In fact, he says his dad was a deacon, his grandfather was a priest, and he did not know the true God. That's quite an admission for somebody that's well on in years to look back at their teenage years and see that kind of perspective. He said it was there, meaning amongst his captors when he was in slavery to Ireland back then, when he was a teenager, it was there that the Lord opened up my awareness of my lack of faith. Even though it came about late, I recognized my failings, and so I turned with all my heart to the Lord my God, and he looked down on my lowliness and had mercy on my youthful ignorance. He guarded me before I even knew him. And before I came to wisdom and could distinguish between good and evil, he protected me and consoled me as a father does for his son. That, he says, is why I cannot be silent. Nor would it be good to do so. About such great blessings and such a gift that the Lord so kindly bestowed in the land of my captivity. This is how we can repay such blessings, when our lives change and we come to know God, to praise and to bear witness to his great wonders before every nation under heaven. So this really sets us up to understand kind of his theology, his setting, and what he is going to address as far as what has happened through his life. When he thinks back to his time of slavery, he says, first of all, it was my fault. It was my fault because I did not and I refused to know God. Therefore, God sent me suffering so that I might know him. And again, the Lord opened up his awareness to his lack of faith there in captivity and slavery. And then he expresses this to say that all of this has happened. And then God has even protected him before he knew him and then brought about such great blessings. And then he says, why? All of this to praise and bear witness of his great wonders before every nation under heaven. And again, from Patrick's perspective, Ireland represents the furthest east, excuse me, I made that same mistake last week, the furthest west that the land goes. After that is the unexplored ocean, that is the Atlantic Ocean. And so the understanding was that this, as far as for this direction, is the push of the gospel. And God used me as part of that. And he used my suffering. He used my youthful ignorance. He used all of these things to bring about the salvation of many people. What a great thing. Paragraph 4. Oh, by the way, if you are wanting to follow along and you're in the live chat or you are listening to the podcast of this in the show notes, again, like always, whenever I have a primary source up, I'm going to have a link to a good translation of it that is available for free. There's so many that I have that are behind paywalls, and I always try to make it so that you can just click a link and see it there. I don't want anyone to have to pay for things that are in our own history. That's crazy. But this one here, you will find directly available there. It's in the fourth paragraph that we pick up. He says, this is because there is no other God, nor will there ever be, nor was there ever, except God the Father. He is the one who was not begotten, the one without a beginning, the one from whom all beginnings come, the one who holds all things. By the way, I love that title right there, the one from whom all beginnings come. That's got to be one of my favorite titles that somebody in church history writes about God the Father. The one who holds all things in being, this is our teaching, and his Son, Jesus Christ, whom we testify has always been, since before the beginning of this age, with the Father in a spiritual way. He was begotten in an indescribable way before every beginning. Everything we can see, and everything beyond our sight, was made through him. He became a human being, and having overcome death, was welcomed to the heavens to the Father. The Father gave him all power over every being, both heavenly and earthly and beneath the earth. Let every tongue confess that Jesus Christ, in whom we believe and whom we await to come back to us in the near future, is Lord and God. He is judge of the living and the dead. He rewards every person according to their deeds. He has generously poured on us the Holy Spirit, the gift and promise of immortality, who makes believers and those who listen to be children of God and co-heirs with Christ. This is the one we acknowledge and adore, one God in a trinity of the sacred name. Now, if I was a theologian in the 5th century, I would be hard-pressed to write a better paragraph than that. You can obviously see overtones and influences from various church documents, but then you can see his own way of communicating this. Now, this would have been mid-400s. So obviously we've already had a couple of church councils. One of the most influential, in fact, the most influential, the Council of Nicaea, would have been over 100 years before this. So he would have absolutely come across that. But I find it fascinating some of the changes that he makes here. And they're not changes of substance. They're really just changes in communication. The way that he says this is not, I'm going to understand exactly how the Son was begotten of the Father. He says he was begotten by the Father in an indescribable way before every beginning. In other words, the Son did not have a beginning. That's actually a remarkable way to put it, because as you well know, if you are a student of the 4th or 5th century, Arianism had been pushed out of the Roman Empire to the extremes. Now, so it would go either to the east or to the north. A lot of the northern Germanic tribes became Arian, but then also influences of it would have been felt at the extremes of the west, here where Patrick was working. And so the use of good theology but communicated in a more handy way is really fascinating. I like the way he does this, and I love the way he expresses this. And I want you to see again, he puts on this expectation that Christ is coming back in the near future. This has always been one of the expectations of the church. In some ways, that is a good thing, because near is a very relative term. Obviously, Christ's return is part and parcel to the gospel's hope. But that kind of perspective, again, we now know we sit here almost 1,600 years later, and Christ has still not come back yet, and yet we still anticipate his return in the near future. And so that shouldn't be so much definitional as much as it should be hopeful, and it should be at the center of our promises from Christ, is not that he would save us from this suffering or that, but that our sufferings in the meantime, while we await him, are used for his purposes and for the sharing of the gospel. This is something that Patrick will teach us very, very succinctly here. Let's jump ahead to paragraph 6 here. Although I am imperfect in many ways, he says, I want my brothers and relations to know that what I am really like, so that they can see what it is that inspires my life. Again, to have this kind of perspective from an influential theologian in history is really second to none. And this is why we're here. Paragraph 7. I am not ignoring the evidence of my Lord, who testifies in the psalm, saying, you destroy those who speak lies. And again, he says, a mouth which lies kills the soul. And the same Lord says in the gospel, the idle words which people speak, they will account for on the day of judgment. And he says, so I should greatly dread with fear and trembling this sentence on that day, where nobody can avoid or escape, but all shall give complete account of what of the least of sins before the tribunal of the Lord Christ. And he says this in paragraph 9. He says, this is why I have long thought to write, but up to now I have hesitated because I feared what people would say. This is because I did not learn as others did, who drank in equally well both the law and the sacred writings, and never had to change their way of speaking since childhood, but always grew better and better at it. For me, however, my speech and words have been translated into a foreign language. As it can be easily seen from my writings, the standard of the instruction and learning I have had. As it is said, the wise person is known through speech, and also understanding and knowledge is in the teaching of truth. However, Patrick says, paragraph 10, even though there's truth in my excuse, it gets me nowhere. But now in my old age, I want to do what I was unable to do in my youth. Now, throughout this, again, he's going to continually remind us that he is not a man of great high learning. He is a simple person. He is a sinner. But he is saved by the grace of God despite all of these things. He says at the close of paragraph 11, he says, "The Spirit is a witness that what is of the countryside is also created by the Most High." So I am first of all, a simple country person, a refugee, and unlearned. I do not know how to provide for the future, but this I know for certain, that before I was brought low, I was like a stone lying deep in the mud. Then he who is powerful came and in his mercy pulled me out, lifted me up, and placed me on the very top of the wall. That is why I must shout aloud in return to the Lord for such great good deeds of his, here and now and forever, which the human mind cannot measure. So be amazed, all you people great and small who fear God, you well-educated people in authority, listen and examine this carefully. Who was it who called one as foolish as I am from the middle of those who are seen to be wise and experienced in law and powerful in speech and everything? If I am most looked down upon, yet he inspired me before others so that I would faithfully serve the nations with awe and reverence and without blame, the nations to whom the love of Christ brought me, his gift was that I would spend my life, if I were worthy of it, to serving them in truth and with humility to the end." There he calls to the attention of those who are criticizing him. Even those who say, you know, not well educated and yet you're ordaining clergy, not well spoken and yet you are preaching. These types of things. Again, Patrick's going to call and say, "Who called me to this though?" Right? Does not God take the lowly? In fact, should we not even, and you can hear the undertones of Paul's reasoning in this, should we not all the more glory in our weaknesses that the glory of God may be put on display? Because when we are weak, he is strong. And this is kind of the backdrop of Christian virtue that he is expressing out of here. Basically saying, I'm not some highly educated, highly learned, highly polished person that was able to pull this off. I did not do this in my own strength. He says, I couldn't even write this early on because I didn't have the ability to communicate in a way that wouldn't get me into trouble. Paragraph 15. I did not deserve at all that the Lord would grant such great grace. After hardships and troubles, after captivity, and after so many years among that people, it was something which, when I was young, I never hoped for or even thought of. What God did through Patrick was unique. There's no denying that. His influence to the, even to the entire nation of Ireland, but his influence to Irish Christianity for 1,500 years is unparalleled. I mean, here I sit. I'm in New York. I am Reformed Baptist. I am not, I am partially Irish, but even one of my rings, one of my favorite things is an Irish cross that has to do with Patrick's own usage of things in his land. I mean, that kind of influence is not small. It is absolutely enormous. Paragraph 16. After I arrived in Ireland, I tended sheep every day. I prayed frequently during the day. More and more the love of God increased. This is calling back to when he was a slave, when he was in his late teens. It says, more and more the love of God increased, and my sense of awe before God. Faith grew, and my spirit was moved, so that in one day I would pray up to 100 times. And at night, perhaps even the same. I even remained in the woods and on the mountain, and I would rise to pray before dawn and snow and ice and rain. I never felt the worse for it, and I never felt lazy. As I realize now, the Spirit was burning in me at that time. I'm not going to read this entire narrative section about him getting on a ship and all these types of things. You're welcome to go and read it. I provided the links to do so. But I'm really here not to get the narrative so much as the wisdom that he learns from all of this. So we are going to skip ahead to paragraph 26, where he tells another story. He says, one time I was put to the test by some superiors of mine. They came and put my sins against my hard work as a bishop. Now he, of course, is going much further forward, much further forward in his own history, that this is not a This is not a time when he was in his late teens. Now he is, after having gone back to Britain, he had become a bishop and then went back to Ireland. And again, someone came up to him and put his sins against him. They came and put my sins against my hard work as a bishop. This hits me very hard, so much so that it seemed I was about to fall, but here and in both here and in eternity. But the Lord in his kindness spared the converts and the strangers for the sake of his name and strongly supported me when I was so badly treated. I did not slip into sin and disgrace. I pray that God not hold this sin against them. They brought up against me, after 30 years, something I had already confessed before I was even a deacon. What happened was that one day, when I was feeling anxious and low, with a very dear friend of mine, I referred to some things that I had done one day, rather in 1 hour when I was young, before I overcame my weakness. I do not know, God knows, whether I was then 15 years old at the time, and I did not then even believe in the living God. Not even when I was a child. In fact, I remained in death and unbelief until I was reproved strongly and actually brought low by hunger and nakedness daily. My defense was that I remained on in Ireland, and that not of my own choosing until I almost perished. However, it was very good for me, since God straightened me out, and he prepared for me for what I would be today. I was far different then from what I am now, and I have care for others, and I have enough to do to save them. In those days, I did not even have concern for my own welfare. Again, he goes to this story about how he addressed a certain betrayal in his own life. He had admitted a sin that he had committed in his teenage years to a friend of his, and then it was brought up again 30 plus years later. Something that he already confessed and had gotten through, and again, this is part of him writing towards the end of his life and saying, you know, here's some rumors you may have heard about me. Here's some things you may have heard about me. Let me tell you how that started. Let me tell you what happened. I mean, betrayal like that that's pretty frustrating. As it says in paragraph 30, okay, hang on a second. Let me pause here for a second. We have something in the chat. You should mention the name of the YouTube channel in the recording. It's kind of difficult to find out about you if you discovered the podcast through. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty fair. There's a reason for that. I'm responding to live chat for those of you who are listening. There's a reason I don't typically do that is the YouTube channel was just a way to live stream this so people at church could listen along live. It really is a very small part of the whole thing. But yes, so let me put it up in the that's a good suggestion. Let me put it up in here. If you are listening to the podcast, and I know there's many, many, many people and vast majority of people listen there. If you want to join us live streamed on Wednesday nights, you can find us on YouTube. It's called Church History and Theology. You can find us there. You can watch the video of this, et cetera. Yep. Good suggestion. Okay. Paragraph 30. Let's get back to Patrick here. For that reason, I give thanks to the one who strengthened me in all things so that he would not impede me in the course I had undertaken and from the works also, which I had learned from Christ, my Lord. Rather, I sensed in myself no little strength from him, and my faith passed the test before God and people. He says, I make bold to say that my conscience does not blame me, now and in the future. I have God for my witness that I have not told lies in the account I have given to you. But I grieve more for my very dear friend that we had to hear such an account, the one to whom I entrusted my very soul. I did learn from some brothers before the case was heard that he came to my defense in my absence. I was not there at the time, not even in Britain, and it was not I who brought up the matter. In fact, it was he himself who told me from his own mouth, quote, look, you are being given the rank of bishop, unquote. That is something I did not deserve. How could he then afterwards come to disgrace me in public before all, both good and bad, about a matter for which he had already freely and joyfully forgiven me, as indeed had God, who is greater than all? Again, betrayal. Oh, man. Yeah, that's going to get personal. If there's anything that's going to dissuade you from ministry, betrayal is going to be one of the big ones. When somebody you confide in, when somebody that you trust turns on you, that's a rough one. That's a tough one to swallow, especially when they do so when you're not there. Backbiting and intrigue and all that and gossip in the halls and things that is some of the most unchristian stuff you'll ever witness. And unfortunately I see it all the time. Yeah, so if you're doing that, stop. Don't do that. Go and speak to that person. Don't be like that. Paragraph 34. He says, "So I'll never stop giving thanks to my God, who kept me faithful in my time of temptation. I can today with confidence offer my soul to Christ my Lord as a living victim. He is the one who defended me in all my difficulties. I can say, 'Who am I, Lord?' or 'What is my calling, that you have worked with me with such divine presence?' This is how I came to praise and magnify your name among the nations all the time, wherever I am, not only in good times, but in the difficult times too. Whatever comes about for me, good or bad, I ought to accept them equally and give thanks to God." Now, I'm going to pause right there in that sentence for a little while. There's a lot of wisdom coming out of Patrick's writings here, and that's a really, really good one. That is something that I have learned. I say this to my shame. I've been a Christian almost 30 years now. This summer, it'll be 30 years. And it took me until last year to thank God for bad times and difficulties while they're going on. I thanked God for bad things and difficulties after the fact. I've been at least to that point for a good long while in my Christian walk. But it really wasn't even until about last year that I was able to actually thank God equally for good times and bad. And that wasn't due to Patrick. I just, while I'm passing over this, I realize these are things that are only learned when you're in the arena. These are things that are difficult to learn. To be able to come through difficulty and be able to come through, excuse me, suffering, and to say, I can thank God in the middle of this, and to be able to rejoice in what He is doing, even though you have no concept about what role it plays. You don't know what's the outcome going to be, but you just know the one that you're traveling with is a gracious God who leads you through good and bad. This is what I would call a straight reliance upon the providence of God, and it is something you have to learn through difficulties as a maturing Christian. So it is not something that comes easy. It is not something that comes natural. I do not believe it comes immediately upon salvation either. It is something that takes time, a long time. Sometimes for me, it took 29 years. I hope for everyone it's taken less time, because I'll tell you, there is nothing like the perspective of being able to say, I do not understand why all of this is happening, but I do know my God, and therefore I will not despair. And I will thank Him for the difficulties while they are going on. All right, let's keep going. Had to make mention of that as we go through. Patrick continues. He says, "He has shown me that I can put my faith in Him without wavering and without end. However ignorant I am, He has heard me, so that in these last days I can dare to undertake such a holy and wonderful work. In this way, I can imitate somewhat those whom the Lord foretold would announce His gospel and witness to all nations before the end of the world." Again, this eschatological expectation has been present in the church's history for a long time. It doesn't mean they were wrong any more than we are wrong. It just means that there is an understanding that there is an end to all of this, a day in which God will judge the world by righteousness. And so in his understanding and in his worldview, he is at the ends of the world, physically, geographically. He is there. Everything after that is just water in that direction. And so for him, there's not only just a time element to this, but there is also the geographical element of this. We have this responsibility to do, and then the end comes. He continues on. He says, "This is what we see has been fulfilled. Look at us. We are witnesses that the gospel has been preached right out to where there is nobody else there." Again, that's the geographical understanding. Excuse me. As the geographical understanding of how distant even Ireland is to be seen with regards to the gospel's spread around the world. Now, obviously, we know the world is much bigger than Patrick knew about. But his perspective on this affords us a great deal of wisdom. That it doesn't matter where we are, it doesn't matter if we're actually at the ends of the world or not, we have a responsibility to be witnesses to the gospel, and our suffering is part of that. No matter what God uses us for, one of the most pertinent responsibilities of the Christian is to never lose sight of the grace of God. And I want you to see this here in paragraph 38. He says, I am greatly in debt to God. He gave me such great grace that through me, many people should be born again in God and brought to full life. Also that clerics should be ordained everywhere for this people who have lately come to believe. That's the Irish. That's the Irish people. And who the Lord has taken from the ends of the earth. That is just what he promised in the past through his prophet. Quote, the nations will come to you from the ends of the earth, and they will say, how false are the idols our fathers got for themselves, and they are of no use whatever. And again, I have put you as a light to the nations, that you may be their salvation to the end of the earth. It was there that I await his promise, he says. He is the one who never deceives. As is repeated in the gospel, quote, they will come from the east and from the west, and they will lie down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, unquote. We believe that believing people will come from all over the world. It is right, then, that we should fish well and diligently. I love that. I love that quote. I don't know. Every time I run into something like this in church history, I always go, you know, man, I'd like that on my wall. It is right, then, that we should fish well and diligently. There he refers to being fishers of men, obviously. And, well, as he quotes in the very next phrasings there, that there is a diligence that is necessary for the spreading of the gospel, and there is a way to do it well and a way to do it not well. And I believe that Patrick here emphasizes how to do it well is to never lose sight of the grace of God. What does he say here? All of this is on the subject of grace. God is the one who brought people to full life, and Patrick, at the end of his life, and after all of this visibly successful sharing of the gospel throughout Ireland, says, I am still greatly in debt to God. That should be the perspective of Christians who are in ministry of any measure. Don't ever lose sight of the grace of God. It is going to be very easy for you to focus on your successes and to downplay your failures. But what we are to realize is that in our successes, we realize we are indebted to God. And in our failures, we are to realize that we are to be thankful to God for our situations, whether they're good or bad, from our own estimates. Let's jump to paragraph 41. How has this happened in Ireland? Never before did they know of God except to serve idols and unclean things. But now they have become the people of the Lord and are called children of God. The sons and daughters of the leaders of the Irish are seen to be monks and even virgins of Christ. He tells a story of a woman that he baptized. And again, if you want to read these things in paragraphs 42, 43, 44, you're welcome to do so. I provided the links so you can do this. Again, I'm not going to read every aspect of this book. Let's skip forward to paragraph 45. Those who wish may laugh and insult, but I will not be silent. Nor will I hide the signs and wonders which the Lord has shown me even many years before they came about. He knows all things, even before the beginning of time. Again, Patrick, not highly learned, but will run circles around many people I have known that are very learned, with regards to his faith in the providence of God, not just in the foreknowledge, but in the intention of God before the beginnings of time to do what he is intending to do. This is a tacit agreement to the Lord's claim that in all of these things, we do not find ourselves in strange circumstances as far as God is concerned. We find ourselves in his care. And so, again, what's the response of that? And you see it at the opening of their very next paragraph, as he says, so I want to give thanks to God without ceasing. He frequently forgave my lack of wisdom and my negligence, and more than once did not become very angry with me, the one who was meant to be his helper. I was not quick to accept what he showed me, and so the Spirit prompted me. The Lord was merciful to me 1,000,000 times, because he saw in me that I was ready, but that I did not know what I should do about the state of my life. There were many who forbade this mission. They even told stories among themselves behind my back, and they said, why does he put himself in danger among hostile people who do not know God? It was not because they were malicious. They just did not understand, as I myself can testify, since I was just an unlearned country person. Indeed, I was not quick to recognize the grace that was in me. I know now that I should have done what I should have done then. Now, therefore, paragraph 47, if you're following along. Now, therefore, I have informed my brothers and my fellow servants who believed me, because I gave them warning, and I warn them now, in order to strengthen and confirm your faith. Oh, that you would imitate greater things and do more powerful things. This will be my glory, since a wise son is the glory of his father. You all know, and God knows, how I have lived among you since my youth, in true faith and sincerity of heart. Towards the pagan people, too, among whom I live, I have lived in good faith, and I will continue to do so. God knows that I have not been devious to even one of them, nor do I think of doing so for the sake of God and his church. I would not want to arouse persecution of them and of all of us, nor would I want that the Lord's name should be blasphemed on account of me, since it is written, "Woe to the one through whom the name of the Lord is blasphemed." I know that I am inexperienced in all things. Again. But still, I have tried to keep a guard on myself and for the Christians and virgins of Christ and religious women who were giving me small gifts of their own accord. When they would throw some of their ornaments on the altar, I would give them back to them. They were hurt at me that I would do this, but it was because of the hope of the eternal gift that I was careful in all things, in case unbelievers would trap me or my ministry of service for any reason. Nor did I want to give those who could not believe even the slightest reason for speaking against me or taking my character away. Perhaps, however, when I baptized so many thousands of people, did I hope to receive even the smallest payment? If so, tell me, and I will return it to you. Or when the Lord ordained clerics everywhere through my poor efforts, and I gave his service to them for free, if I asked them to pay even for the cost of my shoes, tell it against me, and I will return it to you more. Again, you can see some of the things that are coming against him at the end of his life. This idea that he was using extortion or in some ways taking money from all of these things, and he's saying, look, none of this has ever occurred, not on anything. I have always desired to keep above board on anything at all. And again, if anyone has anything that they were charged directly by me with regards to this, the services that I provide them for free, let me know. I'll pay them everything. I'll return it to you and more. Again, I think this is a good lesson for people to learn. When you are intending all things well, it will not stop people from making things up and doing things that are horrible to you. There's literally, if we were to believe everything that Patrick is saying here, and there's really no reason to understand otherwise, people will just be nasty to you for your success or for your faithfulness. Or because, name a reason. And he's finding himself quite frustrated that it doesn't really matter what he did. He could have stolen all this, he could have not stolen all this, and still the challenge towards him comes the same. And he's like, where's the proof of this? Where is anything? I've never done stuff like this. Doesn't seem to matter. Paragraph 52, at times I gave gifts to kings over and above what I paid to their sons who traveled with me. Despite this, they took me and my companions prisoner and very much wanted to kill me, but the time had not yet come. They stole everything they found in our possession, and they bound me on an iron. On the 14th day, the Lord set me free from their power. All our possessions were returned to us for God's sake and for the sake of the close friendship that we had previously. You know yourselves how much I expended on those who were judges in those regions and I most frequently visited. I estimate that I gave out not less than the price of 15 persons, that is, slaves, so that you might benefit from me, and that I might benefit from you and God. I'm not sorry I did it. Nor was it even enough for me. I still spend. I'll spend more. The Lord is powerful, and he can grant me still to spend my very self for the sake of your souls. Here he's talking about that there were certain aspects of ministry where he needed to send gifts forward to be able to deal with things politically and whatnot. And he's just like, giving away this money, trying to afford a bit of safety or freedom to people to be able to extend out the gospel here and there and whatnot. And he says in paragraph 54, he says, see now, I call on God as witness in my soul. I don't tell you any lies. Nor would I write to you looking for your praise, nor out of greed. It's not that I hope for honor from any of you for myself. It is the honor which is not yet to be seen, but which is believed in the heart, which is that which is what gives me satisfaction. The one who gave the promise is faithful, and he never lies. At the end of all of this, he wraps up with a series of paragraphs that really kind of extend out his hope and his faith in the gospel. And here we come to the end of the confessions. He says, "Now I commend my soul to my most faithful God. For him I perform the work of an ambassador, despite my less than noble condition. However, God is not influenced by such personal situations, and he chose me for this task so that I would be one servant of his very least important servants. So I shall make a return to him for all that he has given to me. But what can I say? Or what can I promise to my Lord? There is nothing I have that is not his gift to me. But he knows the depths of my heart, my very gut feelings. He knows that, excuse me, he knows that it is enough that I desire very much, and I'm ready for this, that he would grant me to drink of his chalice, just as he was pleased to do for others who loved him. For this reason, may God not let it come about that I would suffer the loss of his people, who have become his in the furthermost parts of the earth. I pray that God give me perseverance, and that he grant me to bear faithful witness to him right up to my passing from this life for the sake of my God. If I have ever imitated anything good for the sake of my God whom I love, I ask that he grant me to be able to shed my blood with these converts and captives, even were I to lack a grave for burial, or my dead body were to be miserably torn apart limb from limb by dogs or wild beasts, or were the birds of heaven to devour it. I declare with certainty that if this were to happen, I would have gained both my soul and my body. There is no doubt whatever that we will rise on the appointed day in the brightness of the sun, that is, in the glory of Christ Jesus our Redeemer. We shall be like children of the living God and co-heirs of Christ and be fashioned in his image, since it is from him and through him and in him that we are to reign. The sun which we see rising for us each day at his command, that sun will never reign, nor will its splendor continue forever. And all those who adore that sun will come to a bad and miserable penalty. We, however, believe in and adore the true sun, that is, Christ, who will never perish. Nor will they perish who do his will, but they will abide forever just as Christ will abide forever. He lives with God the Father Almighty and with the Holy Spirit before the ages began, and now, and for all the ages. Amen." Again. "And again I briefly put before you the words of my confession. I testify in truth and in great joy of heart before God and his holy angels that I never had any other reason for returning to that nation from which I earlier had escaped, except the gospel and God's promises. I pray that those who believe in and have reverence for God, some of them may happen to inspect or come upon this writing which Patrick, a sinner without learning, wrote in Ireland. May none of them ever say that whatever little I did or made known to please God was done through ignorance. Instead, you can judge and believe in all truth that it was a gift of God. This is my confession before I die." That's a remarkable way to end that. This description of those who worship the sun in the sky and the comparison and contrast to our adoration of the true sun, that is Christ, who will never perish, is very, very Irish Christianity. And it really sets this tone for something that is very cultural, and then showing the outcome of that in the Christian faith and in the gospel. And it's something that I really appreciate how Patrick is able to do. It does set the stage for many like things in Irish Christianity. You have the Irish cross. You have actually the center of the Irish cross is the sun. And there's all sorts of stuff that comes out of this, really remarkable. And this is why I have a great respect for Patrick. What he does with all of this is not in any way toot his own horn. There is no desire to establish himself above that of others, but he settles out and says, this is my defense. I call God as a witness with regards to these things. You've got concerns about sins when I was young. You've got concerns about this or that money or this. I make defense of what I did above board, across the way. I don't know what else to tell you. And at all points, it was the grace of God who brought me here and kept me here. And I love the way he actually puts this. He says, I never had, and this is in paragraph 61, second to last paragraph, I never had any other reason for returning to that nation from which I had earlier escaped, that is Ireland, except the gospel and God's promises. And I love that in the very final paragraph, he prays for people like you and me. He says, I pray for those who believe in and have reverence for God. Some of them may happen to inspect or come upon this writing, which Patrick, a sinner without learning, wrote in Ireland. May none of them ever say that whatever little I did or made known to please God was done through ignorance. Instead, you can judge and believe in all truth that it was a gift of God. This is my confession before I die. Right here, everything in his life summed up as a gift of God. Salvation, protection, protection in storm, provision, confessions, converts, pictures, the Irish people, his bishopric, his deaconess, all of these things he sees as a gift of God, that he deserved nothing of this. As he began, so he ends. I am Patrick. I'm a sinner, a simple country person, and the least of all believers. Well, I think there is a great deal of wisdom to pull from this guy. One of my favorite things I have ever run across in church history to read and to glean wisdom from. It is something that will sit in my library and I will return to regularly to remind myself of the familiarity of his story, because it sounds so much like the apostles. It sounds so much like Christ, and it should sound so much like us. May God make us grateful for the things that he brings to us, both good and bad, that we may praise him without end. Thank you all for your time. Thank you for tuning in. And we look forward to the next ones in the coming weeks. May God's blessing be on all of you as you seek to follow him through thick and thin. God be praised.